Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome, everybody. We're live from the Vomitorium once again. This is the Ad Nauseam Podcast. My name is Jeff Winkle. I am your co-host, and I'm here with my other co-host, Mr. Dr. Dave Noe. How are you doing today, Dave?
Yeah, Mr. Doctor is doing real well, Jeff. Thanks.
Right. I like to refer to you as Mr. Doctor.
Yeah, you put as many titles in there as you can, right? I used to know someone who referred to themselves as Dr. So-and-so, comma, PhD.
Oh, really?
Yeah, bookending.
Oh, I like that. I think I'm going to steal that.
You're going to use that?
Yeah. So are you enjoying the weather today?
Oh, it's gorgeous here in Michigan. We have sunshine in the sky, no sarcasm.
Nope.
Peeking through the clouds, unseasonably warm temperatures.
Yes, very rare for November.
So let's get it started.
Will you, I think you're going to start us off with a shout out to a faithful listener.
That's right. We want to say hello to our new friend, Mr. Andrew Kuiper.
Hey, Andrew.
He's coming to us from Jakarta, Indonesia.
No, he's not.
Yeah, he really is. He traveled all the way around the world to listen to Ad Nauseam and send us an email.
And then he got back on the plane and flew back
No, I don't think so. Actually said that he used some Ovid in his classroom. He's teaching some classics over there.
Oh, and fabulous.
So that's wonderful. I understand Indonesia is also called Java.
I've heard that.
And speaking of which, we have a large Java-themed announcement.
That's right.
In just a few weeks.
Exactly.
So the listeners
Stay
want to
tuned.
Pay attention to that.
Stay tuned. Excellent.
So Jeff, you have the opening vomit-themed quote from
Picked carefully, hand-picked.
Classical literature.
Right. It's amazing how many there are.
It's incredible.
It is incredible. And this one is from the Roman comic poet Plautus.
Plautus, funny guy.
Yes, from his play Rudens.
Mm-hmm.
And
which means the rope, doesn't it?
I believe so.
Think about the comic potential of a rope.
A rope,
yeah.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Right. And the tragic potential.
That's true.
That's right.
Well, that's pretty dark.
Sorry. I know exactly. On a sunny day, that doesn't fit. Here's the Latin. Pulmoneum edipol nemis velim vomitum vomas.
Alliterative, huh?
Very alliterative, which translates something like, good gravy, I really wish you'd puke up your lungs already.
Huh.
Right. And I want to do this play as an episode just to kind of find out what the context for that
Absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely, yeah. Plautus is amazing.
Let's start puking some things up.
Okay.
Where are we going today?
Today we're
going to
talk about the archaic poet Hesiod. Now, Hesiod lived about 700 BC. We'll give a little more of his biography in a moment. But the opening quote we have is from the late classical scholar M.L. West.
Excellent. Let's hear it.
So this is from 1998 in the Oxford World Classics edition. And he says, Hesiod is a less familiar name to the general reader than Homer, Aeschylus, or Plato. And no one would claim that he is as great a writer as they.
Hmm.
He was nevertheless one of the most famous poets of antiquity, often mentioned in the same breath as Homer, as the other main representative of the early worldview.
West sets up a tension there.
There's definitely tension. I was struck by this as I was preparing for this episode. He says, first of all, no one would claim that Hesiod is as great a writer as Homer, Aeschylus, or Plato.
Yeah.
But then he says in the next sentence that Hesiod was often mentioned in the same breath as Homer.
Right, so what happened?
I don't really know. I think, as we'll see, a lot of Hesiod is really not to modern tastes in some ways.
You think that's probably the
I think
the
so.
Main
there's
thing?
There's a lot of misogyny, either, you know, hatred of women, either real or close to it,
mm-hmm.
right? And then there are some unusual kind of aphoristic peasanty references that aren't going to strike the modern ear as quite as palatable.
And certainly in terms of a narrative, it doesn't flow like Homer.
It does not have a narrative.
Right, exactly.
For sure. But it's a fascinating poem, and that's why we've chosen to cover it.
Yes, fascinating and important.
Important, yeah. Absolutely. With some really memorable episodes lodged inside of it.
Yes, absolutely.
So we're going to be developing today this theme, right, that Hesiod is one of the most underrated poets in antiquity.
Yeah.
That's my brief, you might say. That's where I'm headed.
At the end of the episode, we can come back, and you're going to come down.
Well, we're going to take a look. We're going to try to decide. Does Hesiod deserve a little more attention than he's gotten, or is it okay to keep him on the back shelf?
All right, so let's get a little into the biography or the life of Hesiod, I mean, as it presents itself in the poem, which is really our only source for Hesiod.
Yeah, later authors talked about him, but we have really very little solid information.
Right. One of the interesting things about Hesiod, say, compared to Homer, is that there is actual biographical information in his poetry, whereas
Correct.
With Homer, there's not.
It's all speculation.
All speculation. There are traditions about where Homer was from, but Hesiod, at least on the page, he appears to be a more historical figure.
Right. So the fluret date, you'll often see in works of classical scholarship, FL period, And that stands for fluerit, right? The Latin verb that means when he was at his peak.
Yes.
Right? When he started his first podcast, you might say.
That's right, exactly.
And this was about 700 BC, right? So this puts him one or two generations removed from Homer.
Right.
And one of the fascinating things about Hesiod is that he quotes Homer verbatim, whole lines.
Yeah.
There's one school of thought that says Hesiod precedes Homer, but that is not the popular school.
Right.
You know, the far more prevalent is that he was a younger, near contemporary, two to three generations.
Yeah, and the fact that he quotes Homer just shows how embedded Homer had already become.
Definitely.
In the culture.
And we're going to talk in a few moments about the difference between an aristocratic and a more common man view of Greek antiquity.
Yes.
Which is what Hesiod gives us, the latter. So he's at the foot of Mount Helicon at the town of Askra. So this is in the region of Boeotia,
yes.
Right? North of Athens. Have you been to Boeotia, Jeff?
I have. I've been to Thebes.
You traveled through there. There's not a lot in Thebes to see.
No, it's kind of disappointing. It was as mythic as that town was.
Very important town in antiquity. But now as you drive past Thebes, what I remember is seeing solar farms, acre, mile after mile of solar panel farms.
Yeah.
None of the heroic ethos I was hoping for.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, my outstanding memory of Thebes, I had an interesting encounter with an inebriated Greek biker up on the Acropolis. But we'll save that for another time.
You can't
time.
Get enough of those. So he's from the foot of Mount Helicon, a town called Askra, which just sounds harsh
it
and
does.
Difficult. But he says that his father was from the Aeolid, that is, east of there, from a town called Cumae. So Hesiod writes in an aphoristic style.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that he has a number of small, witty, clever, memorable sayings, one strung right after the next.
And they're not so connected to each other.
Not really connected.
No.
So it's very much like the Proverbs of the Old Testament, if the listeners are familiar with that. Here's a wise thing to do or not to do. And then the next one, after you've digested the first, is on a different topic, but equally wise and polished, kind of.
You're right. When we talk about Hesiod not being all that connected, narratively speaking, this is part of that.
That's right. I kind of liken it to the wise things my grandmother used to say.
Ooh, do share.
Well, I don't know where these came from, these tales of folklore. I think they were maybe Welsh or Scots-Irish. That's her background. But she used to say things like, that's a fine kettle of fish. People probably are familiar with that one,
yeah.
Right? But then there were some more unusual ones like, that's better than a peck on the head with a sharp rock. That was the standard, right?
That's a pretty low bar.
Well, if someone's not whacking you on the head with a sharp rock, you're doing pretty well.
I guess so.
And so these stuck out to me as a memorable, clever, witty, compact sorts of expressions.
Yeah, that's great. My grandma just used to yell, stop it. And is it fine kettle of fish? Isn't that what, like... Hardy would always say to Laurel or vice versa.
It's always disappointing when you find out that something that you believed was old and rooted and soily, you know, actually is part of a Saturday morning cartoon,
right,
or something
exactly.
like that.
Right.
It's a disappointing feeling.
Yeah. But Hesiod is full of this stuff.
Yes, definitely. So Jeff, in addition to the aphoristic style, what else is Hesiod known for?
He is known for, unfortunately, I suppose, his misogyny.
Really?
Yes, the hatred of women.
Okay.
And so, I mean, we'll explore this when we get down to the Pandora episode is probably the most notable episode for this kind of thing.
Right.
But you have to talk about it when you talk about Hesiod.
Definitely. So what about his major works?
What about them?
Well, there are two in particular.
There are.
Right?
The Theogony.
Yeah.
The Birth of the Gods.
Yeah. Where'd the gods come from? Everybody wants to know.
That's right. Kind of the closest thing we get to kind of a kind of canonical Greek creation story.
Definitely. But notable because, unlike, you know, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the gods come from somewhere.
That's right. Right?
The gods are not self-made in the Greek tradition.
No ex nihilo here.
That's right. So this is Hesiod's take on the family tree of the gods, their genealogy.
Right. So in that, it tells the story of kind of how Zeus and his cronies got to be in power.
But we're not talking about the Theogony today,
are
we?
We're not. Another episode.
Yeah, the second work is called Works and Days.
That's what we're talking about today.
Yeah, 928 verses. So about 1,000 verses. It's the equivalent of maybe a book and a half of Homer.
Yeah, not
or
long.
Or maybe even two books.
Yep.
So it's short.
What does he address? What does he talk about in this?
Well, it's quite packed, and it flows along, not in a narrative way, but with one complete episode after another, kind of loosely strung together.
That's right. And he's talking to his brother.
That's right. His brother Perses, with whom he was embroiled in a lawsuit.
That's right. And this is not Perseus.
Nope.
Perses.
No. Many of the names of antiquity, they are very similar. This is one of the difficulties when you are a student of the classics, trying to keep the different names straight. I've struggled with it many times.
Yeah.
This is not Perseus, but Perses.
Perses.
And his brother's kind of a scoundrel.
That's right.
And Hesiod is suffering because of it. So he's going to take Perses to task He's going to set him straight. In addition, we have this strong contrast between the agricultural and the commercial lifestyle.
That's right.
So which is preferable in Hesiod's view?
The poem has a lot to say about nature.
Yes.
And
agriculture.
Agriculture, being closer to nature.
Definitely.
Is preferred. And so agriculture over the commercial.
Yeah, the Thomas Jefferson-Alexander Hamilton dispute. Which way is the country going to go? It can be gentlemen farmers or, you know, overseas adventurers and merchants. Hesiod's definitely on the side of the gentleman farmer.
Yes, and I think it's you see kind of the seed of that divinization of nature that you see in so much subsequent Greek and Latin poetry.
Definitely. Yeah, it is everywhere, and it's a very important theme. We also have these interesting episodes, which we're going to touch on in more detail in a moment.
Yep.
The five ages of the world.
Yes.
Right? The golden age down to the iron age. We have the story of Pandora and the jar.
That's right.
And we're going to end today with the fable of the hawk and the nightingale.
Excellent.
One of my favorite little vignettes in all of Greco-Roman literature.
All right, let's get into this stuff. Dave, you want to start us off by reading some Greek?
I would love to. That's one of my favorite things to do.
Let's do it.
So this is from the Erga Kaihemerai, that is the works and the days, the first two lines. Musai pi erie thenaoi de synkleusai. Deute dien nepetes veteron pater humne usai.
So we have the invocation to the muse.
That's right.
Which is kind of a standard for epic poetry. Yep. The dactylic hexameter once again.
Mm-hmm.
The same meter that we see in the Iliad and the Odyssey.
So the first word, right, of Hesiod's poem is muses. And I'm going to read here from the 2009 translation of Stephanie Nelson, generously provided to us by Hackett, our sponsor. And this is how the first two lines go. Muses who dwell on Pieria, you who through song give glory, come, speak of Zeus, him your father, through whom mortal men are known and unknown, famous, forgotten, at the will of great Zeus.
Hmm. So Pieria is often taken to be kind of the home of the muses, up in the area of Mount Olympus, northern Greece.
That's right. That's not right. Far from Helicon.
No. Hesiod is often himself depicted on Mount Helicon receiving a visit from the muses.
Yes, he is thought to have been a humble shepherd, right? He's a contemporary of the prophet Amos from the Old Testament, very close in time.
Oh, I didn't know that, yeah.
And there have been a number of parallels drawn between them.
Yeah.
And their complaints are similar. You know, the rich are exploiting the poor, the peasants are getting the shaft, and Hesiod is in trouble here from his brother Perses.
That's right.
So Jeff, after this initial hymn to Zeus,
yes,
starts out on this religious theme, the muses, of course, the daughters of Zeus and Memory, Mnemosyne, right, the nine muses, then Hesiod heads off in another direction. He talks about competition or strife. Can
That's
you read
right.
a little bit of that for us?
Yes, I'm going to be reading from the Stanley Lombardo translation from 1993, where Hesiod says, it looks like there's not just one kind of strife. That's Eris, after all, but two on the earth. You'd praise one of them once you got to know her, but the other's plain blameworthy. They've just got completely opposite temperaments.
Hmm. So what are the two different kinds of strife? Eris, right, or discordia,
right,
divorce and anger and arrogance and attacking one another without reason or merit. But what's the second kind?
So I believe this is unique to Hesiod, or at least it begins here. I mean, so Eris is discord. Probably most famous in Greek mythology is the one who kind of gets the whole Trojan War story going.
She does.
Right?
She's the only person who's not invited to the wedding of Peleus and Thetis.
Right.
The last person you want at your wedding is the goddess of divorce.
Exactly, right. So you disinvite her at your peril too.
Mm-hmm.
But the second kind is more competitive strife, what the Greeks called the agon, the struggle, competition.
Mm.
And Hesiod suggests that's the kind of struggle, the kind of discord that can move civilization forward.
That can, you want that.
You want that. You can. That can be good for a man to do that, to engage with that. Yeah.
So I have a little bit of that here, again, from the Nelson translation. The other kind, the firstborn, the child of dark night, Zeus, son of Kronos, high-throned, who dwells in brightness, set in the roots of the earth, and for men she is better. It is she who stirs an unhandy man, even him, to start working. For one man watches another and feels then a longing for work when he looks at a rich man who hastens to plow and sow and set his household in order. So neighbor envies his neighbor as he hastens towards wealth, for this strife is a good one for mortals.
Sounds like Hesiod's a capitalist.
I was just thinking the same
thing. Were you really?
the sense that Hesiod says, okay, there's bad, destructive strife, but the good kind is the kind that motivates you to compete with your neighbor, to keep up with the Joneses.
Right. And when I teach things, more kinds of a broader look at Greek history. One of the questions I often like to pose to my students is, what made the Greeks so extraordinary?
I mean, right.
Why this tiny kind of rocky culture? Why did they make such a big splash mm-hmm. compared to some of these other cultures around the Mediterranean? And I often will point to this aspect, kind of that mm-hmm. that agonistic part of society really, it really made them leap ahead in many
Absolutely.
Ways.
I would couple that with also their great credulity. So the Greeks are thought to be and often expressed as big children.
Oh, yeah.
This is how the Romans saw them. Right, those silly Greeks.
Right.
They'll believe anything. They believed anything. Their capacity for faith, confidence, was enormous.
Right.
This explains, in large part, some of the more hostile things they say about other cultures, right? They're totally dismissive of the Egyptians, totally dismissive of the Persians, right?
Yeah.
Not with any good basis. I mean, these other cultures were older and much more advanced, but the Greeks just kind of brush it all off and say, nah, we're better.
Exactly. You know? Those Barbaroi.
That's right.
Yeah.
Just a kind of large confidence. So the agonistic element that we see here in Hesiod, but then also the credulity, that is the inclination to believe just about anything.
Yeah.
This explains maybe, or digressing, but their scientific interest.
Right.
Just an enormous curiosity, an immense capacity for investigation.
Right. So credulity, but also a willingness to ask questions at every turn.
Right.
Yeah.
So where does this good strife take Hesiod next? This kind of competition, you see your neighbor's working hard, you want to keep up, your neighbor has a pickup truck or three,
yeah,
and you're riding a bike, so you got to compete.
Right. So he turns it on his brother.
So Jeff Hesiod himself is engaged in the wrong kind of strife
yes.
with his own brother Perses.
That's right.
So how does that go?
So Hesiod says, you know, once you have all your work done and your barns are filled with wheat, well, yeah, then have at it. But he's had this falling out with his brother, who is taking advantage of their inheritance. They've split up the inheritance. They split up the land. But he says his brother Perses keeps taking more and more, and he's bribing the local kings with these ill-gotten gains.
Right. Let me read a little bit from Nelson.
Please.
Already we have divided the farm, Hesiod says, but you, Perses, kept on grabbing, carrying off the most of it, feeding the kings with great glory, gift gobblers, who like judging this kind of justice. Idiots.
Yeah. Idiots.
I like that Nelson translation there.
All right. So do you read that as Perses is, he's not doing the agon correctly?
He's too acquisitive. This is the notion of moderation. And as I was reading the scholar Werner Jaeger, his book Paideia, he points out something I had forgotten, which is that Aristotle begins the Nicomachean Ethics with a reference to Hesiod, the concept of moderation, right? So bad strife, there's no limits on it. It just cuts people up.
Right.
Good strife, you pursue it, but not at all costs.
Ah, okay.
And so maybe this is what's especially noxious to Hesiod, is that his own brother has no sense of limitation on his strife.
Yes, that kind of that golden mean
right.
that we're supposed to be striving for. Yeah, I like that.
So like you were saying, this is the narrative thread on which the entire poem, 1,000 verses or so, is strung. But then we quickly move into one of the most fascinating aspects, which is the story of Prometheus and Pandora.
Right.
But before we get to that, we need to hear from our first sponsor.
Yes.
So today's episode is sponsored in part by Hackett Publishing.
Yes, very excited to have them on board with the podcast. We're even using some of their translations on this episode.
Yes, we're using Hesiod, the Lombardo, and the Nelson. Can our listeners go to HackettPublishing.com and get some of these same sorts of resources that we're making use of?
Yes, they can, and they can get a great deal.
Wow. Tell me more about that, Jeff.
So if you go to the website and you plug in the coupon code AN2020, you get 20% off your purchase and free shipping.
So that's AN as in ad nauseum.
Yes.
And then 2020.
Yes.
You enter that at the shopping cart near the checkout time.
Yes,
it's
obvious where you need to do it. Yeah.
And then you go to your mailbox and you get a package full of Hackett Publishing books.
Yes.
Which will help you go deeper into your appreciation of classics as a way of life.
That's exactly right. Great translations, great artwork,
beautiful,
very readable,
stuff.
Good
so
stuff.
So grateful to have the sponsorship of Hackett.
Yes. So let's get into the famous Pandora episode. I mean, the narrative jump is a bit jarring. His hook is, he's explained to his brother why life is so difficult, why it is so difficult to work and to fill your silos with grain. But he uses a kind of a larger story to describe why human life is such a pain.
So Hesiod gives us the story of the fall.
Yes.
In Greek myth.
Right. It's a kind of I think this and the Five Ages, it's a kind of theology of evil to
Definitely.
Some degree. Right.
And it came because Prometheus was a friend of human beings.
Right.
And as a result of his friendship, he stole fire from the gods.
That's right.
So Prometheus is a titan, mm-hmm. that earlier generation that comes before the gods.
Right.
But why does Zeus not like human beings?
The way I always read it is Zeus sees the generation of humanity as yet another generation that could rise up and overthrow him in the same way that his generation rose up and overthrew the Titans.
You're talking about my generation?
Exactly. I'm talking about your generation, okay. My generation.
Right. And so Prometheus steals fire as a way to aid human beings.
Right.
So how does he get the fire out of Olympus?
Well, you smuggle it in a fennel stalk.
A fennel stalk, you say?
Of course. Right. How do you smuggle your fire?
I don't know. What is fennel?
Fennel, I see it at the grocery store. It's bulby.
Walking down another aisle?
No, it's non-mobile.
Okay.
I mean, I buy it very rarely just because the taste is so strong.
I think you're thinking of anise.
I'm not thinking of anise. I've made stuff with fennel. Anise and fennel, I think they share a taste quality.
A tasteless quality?
A tasteless quality. Okay. Or a little goes a long way.
Mm-hmm.
So Prometheus has a big stalk of this stuff.
Right.
And it's probably so stinky that he thinks nobody's gonna come near me if I have a stalk of fennel.
Kind of a tube.
A tube.
That's what some of the translations say. In a tube of fennel, he took the fire from Olympus.
Right.
And Zeus, in retribution...
He creates Pandora.
Let's make a woman.
Let's make a woman. He doesn't do it, but he outsources the job to the other Olympians. Right.
So here's the Nelson translation. Son of Iapetus. So that's Prometheus.
Right.
So Zeus is talking to him. Son of Iapetus, all cunning, wily in plots. You delight in your stealing of fire and in outwitting me. That's not tough to do. It will be a plague, a great one to you and to men to come. I too will give them a gift, an evil one, answering fire, in which all will delight in their hearts as they embrace their own evil. So Zeus's creation to curse men is...
A woman.
A woman.
Yes. And this
Pandora.
Is where, when we talk about Hesiod's misogyny, this is what most people are referring to.
Yes. And what does the name Pandora mean?
It means something like the all gift.
Okay.
The all gifty one.
Kind of like a grab bag.
A grab
of gifts.
Bag. Exactly right. Either a gift from all the gods.
All right. So each of them put their own finishing touches on it.
Yes. And or a gift from the gods to all of humanity.
I see.
Yes. And that would be a sarcastic way of looking
okay.
at it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And to whom is this woman delivered, Pandora?
Well, Zeus doesn't give the woman to Prometheus, but gives him to his slow-witted brother, Epimetheus.
Epimetheus.
Right.
These names are interesting because Prometheus means something along the lines of foresight.
Foresight.
And Epimetheus?
That means afterthought.
Afterthought.
Right. So he's the guy you want to give the gift to.
Correct, because right. he's not going to notice what's going on until it's too late.
That's right.
Some people learn by precept. Some people learn by consequence.
That's right. Exactly right. So Zeus, who's not the most clever of gods, even he knows who to foist this off on.
That's right. So these are both Titans, Prometheus and Epimetheus.
Yes.
Who's responsible for making the woman?
A bunch of different gods and goddesses. Hephaestus, the smith god, has a large hand. Athena, Aphrodite, and Hermes. Shall I read a little bit?
Yes, please.
Okay.
From the Lombardo?
Yeah, from the Lombardo translation. Then he, that's Zeus, called Hephaestus and told him to hurry and knead some earth and water. And put a human voice in it, and some strength, and to make the face like an immortal goddess's face, and then the figure like a beautiful, desirable virgin's. Then he told Athena to teach her embroidery and weaving, and Aphrodite golden to spill grace on her head in painful desire and knee-weakening anguish. And he ordered the quicksilver messenger Hermes to give her a bitchy mind and a cheating heart.
Hmm, that's rough.
That is rough.
So what's the Greek word there?
It's for...
That Zeus uses with respect to Hermes.
It's probably something like dog-like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like kuon.
Kuon, yeah.
Yeah, give her the mind of a dog.
That's right.
Right? So that she is crafty and clever. That's some pretty strong misogyny there, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's interesting. We never really see Pandora as kind of a full-fledged character.
No, she's a stand-in.
She doesn't speak.
No.
Right. But you have those kind of those twin aspects of women being devious. And also kind of they have a sexual allure that's mm-hmm. impossible to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There are some positive elements in here as well, but I think they're easily outweighed by the negatives.
Exactly right. So sometimes Pandora is something, she's called the Greek Eve, right?
Right.
She's the conduit, the female conduit by which wickedness, evil enters into the world.
Hmm. So the various gods finish putting Pandora together.
That's right.
And then Zeus, with his messenger Hermes, sends it down to Epimetheus.
And he takes it.
He takes it.
Without
I have
question.
A little bit of the Nelson quote here. And Epimetheus never thought of what his brother Prometheus had told him, to take no gift from Olympian Zeus, but send it right back.
Send it back.
So you get packages on your doorstep from UPS, right?
That's right.
You always take them into the house.
Of course.
Unthinkingly. In fact, they're so sophisticated now, they take a photo of my front porch and send it to me on my phone.
I don't need that.
It's a little creepy.
It is a little creepy.
Epimetheus, though, had no sagacity. He was not at all shrewd. Takes the gift in against his brother's better judgment.
Yes.
And then a host of evils is spilled out upon humankind.
That's right.
So tell us about the jar.
Yeah, it's really weird. I'm guessing that many of our listeners will associate Pandora not with a jar, but with a box. A box, right? And when I've taught this in class too, I sometimes ask my students, even before we read it, you know, tell me the story of Pandora. And they will often say, well, she's given a box and she's told not to open it, but her feminine curiosity gets the better of her and she opens it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And there are later versions that I think that that stretch this out.
But we could blame Ovid for it, maybe?
Maybe Ovid, yes. The story has a long afterlife.
Right.
But Hesiod's story is so threadbare. Again, Pandora is given no motivation and she just suddenly has this jar and she takes the lid off and all of these horrible things fly out of the jar.
Mm-hmm. Right? But what is the one item that's left?
Is hope.
Yes. And is that a good thing for mortals or a bad?
I think that's one of the wonderful kind of teasing nature of these of the image there. What does that mean that hope is left in the jar? One reading of this I really like is this idea that the jar represents womankind. And there's been suggestions that the kind of jar that he's referring to is a kind of like the amphora jar that's kind of the, you know, stereotypical kind of hourglass shape of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so that Pandora stands in for all women here. And the idea that it sounds bad that hope is trapped in the jar, like the one good thing.
That you'd want roaming the earth with all of these evils.
Right. And but if we see the jar as kind of representing woman, maybe the womb of a woman, this idea that hope could be born into the world. Perhaps.
So she's the repository of hope,
yes.
You might say. She still has it.
Exactly. And that's a balance, perhaps, to kind of the more cold, misogynistic interpretation of the story.
A counter argument to that, though, is, at least according to the Nelson translation, that Zeus willed for hope to stay trapped.
Mm.
And since Zeus is the antagonist in this entire account,
that
suggests maybe hope residing with women is actually a bad thing from Zeus's perspective.
I think that's in keeping with the kind of the overall theme. But Zeus is, he's not all that bright.
No.
Right?
But I retreat to what you say, which is that the account that Hesiod gives us is threadbare.
Yes.
The narrative is very thin.
Yes, it's very thin, right? These things are just going to happen out of nowhere, and it's left to later authors to stretch them out and put some meat on the bones.
So as we finish up the Pandora account, where is the human race at this point?
Well, it's not looking good,
mm-hmm.
right? So Hesiod tells us that Pandora puts the lid back on the jar, but not before all these things, horrible things have escaped. Let me just read a little bit from the Lombardo translation to cap this off. Hesiod says, "The woman, Pandora, clamped the lid back on the jar first, all by the plan of the aegis holder, cloud-herding Zeus. But 10,000 or so other horrors spread out among men. The earth is full of evil things, and so is the sea. Diseases wander around just as they please, by day and by night, soundlessly, since Zeus and his wisdom deprive them of voice. There's just no way you can get around the mind of Zeus."
So even though it's small and not very bright, Zeus's mind, you can't get around it.
You can't get around it, right.
Okay.
Yeah, because that's part of the larger tragedy here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you go on from this. Hesiod moves on then to the five ages of mankind.
Right.
The five ages of the human race.
Right. And I know some critics have argued that, I think as an attempt to try to stitch these things together.
Right.
That the Pandora story kind of explains where external evils come from.
Yeah, these are called surd evils, the term S-U-R-D. So these surd evils are things that are clearly wrong.
Yeah.
Typhoon, tsunami, earthquake, but you can't really point to any one person who's responsible.
And in this next episode, The Myth of the Five Ages, which we're going to get into, explains moral evil.
Moral evil.
Or internal evil, right.
So what's the first age?
The first age is the Golden Age.
Okay.
Where everything's great, everything's wonderful. There's a harmony between humans and nature, between humans and gods. Humans aren't gods.
Right.
But they're as close as they've ever been or ever will be.
And Hesiod says that these men and women, they live like gods. Nelson translation, their hearts had no trouble. Toil and sorrow were far from them. Old age and its wretchedness did not come upon them.
That's right.
So no bifocals.
No, nothing. No icky joints.
No, you can eat as much ice cream and popcorn as you want.
Right.
Not worry about it.
You can indulge in casserole if you wanted to.
Casseroles once again.
Yes, right. But not immortal, right? So even though they don't have the pains of old age, they still die. And I think he says something like you're just overcome by sleep.
Yep.
Yeah.
They died as if conquered by sleep.
There you go.
And all that is good was theirs. The fertile plowland brought them crops without stinting, in plenty all on its own.
So you don't have to sweat and toil.
No.
The earth just kind of gives up its bounty.
So this is kind of like the picture of the Garden of Eden.
Exactly right.
The first two chapters of the book of Genesis,
yeah.
You know, before the fall. And in the Simpsons treatment of this, there's a really lovely episode in which, you know, Homer is hankering for some bacon. And you probably remember the pig just walks up and lays down and his side opens up and the bacon pours out.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, exactly. Now, if that's not a golden age, I don't know what is.
I don't know either.
Right. But it's true. If you look at creation stories that survive from traditions around the world, they'll often have this feature is that, you know, how did things begin in kind of perfect nature? And this idea that, you know, as amazing as technology and civilization and walls and buildings are, there's this, you know, inherent tragedy that, you know, every wall we build separates us from where we belong.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the account of the Golden Age ends, they were rich in flocks and close to the gods who are happy.
Right.
They had it all.
They had it all.
And what comes next after gold?
The Silver Age. And so here we have a clear decline. As the metals get less precious, things get worse for humanity.
Okay. So what characterizes the Silver Age? What are some of the qualities and events happening?
We call them big babies.
Big babies.
Yes. And so their lifespan is shorter. I think the key thing here is that they start to be dismissive of the gods.
Okay.
They start to not pay attention to ritual and worship.
Irreligious.
Irreligious. And that so the moral quality from the Golden Age has lessened.
Hmm. Nelson says, this is her translation, 100 years, a child stayed by the side of his lady mother, a great infant, big great, baby.
Yes, big baby.
Being raised and skipping about in the house. Then when they were grown and had come to the measure of youth, through their folly, they lived short lives full of pain, for they could not hold back from wrong. They outraged one another.
There's not like a clear fall here. It's not, there's not the eating of the fruit, right? We don't have a singular person who's disobeying the gods. It's just more of a general generational decline.
There's also the element that you mentioned, which is that they stop making their sacrifices
yes.
to the gods. And in retribution, what does Zeus do?
Well, Zeus covers them over with earth once again.
Hmm.
And we get another generation.
So this would be the Bronze Age.
Yes.
The Bronze Race.
That's right. So continued decline.
Continued decline. And apparently, although they're called Bronze Age, this has always bothered me. They're made of ash.
Made of ash.
The ash tree, you know, the tall, really hard wood that is turned into baseball bats.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't know. On the outside, they're bronze, but they have an ashy center.
Kind of like a nougat.
That's right.
Like a nougat center,
it's
right?
Always been disturbing.
I think I was reading that the ash, they would also make spears out of that.
Yes, I suppose.
As he makes much of that this generation is warlike.
That seems to me like one of those rationalizing accounts.
Yeah.
You know, that you don't just take the story on its own terms, but you try to make it fit some...
I can see that.
Some hyper-philosophical kind of point, so
right.
to speak. So, Nelson, a bronze race, not like the silver, of ash trees, mighty and terrible.
So maybe just ash in terms of it's a strong... Hearty
yes,
wood.
Very much so.
Yeah, okay.
Their only care was the works of the war god, groans, outrage, and insolence. They did not eat bread, and the strong hearts in their breasts were of adamant. Adamant
yeah.
is the same thing that Wolverine is made of. Am I not mistaken?
The claws, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
His whole skull, his whole
Is it all
frame,
made out of adamant?
Eventually, it's fused with adamant.
I think I fell asleep during that origin story.
You can be forgiven for that. So what are they made of? Are they made of bronze? Are they made of ash? Or are they made of adamant?
It is kind of confusing.
It's a hodgepodge.
It is a hodgepodge. Maybe this is another reason maybe Hesiod's not remembered as well as Homer. He's kind of all over the map.
Well, in addition, the Ages of Man story we really get from Ovid.
Right.
He refines it in the Metamorphoses, and he drops the Age of Heroes out, which we're coming to in just a moment.
Yes.
But one of the survivors of the Bronze Age was a man named Talos.
Talos.
You remember on the island of Crete.
Right, right, right.
When Jason and Medea are sailing home from Colchis, they stop, I think it's Crete, not Cyprus, and they encounter someone from the Bronze Age, a holdover.
That's right.
Like a Sasquatch.
And doesn't he have, he's kind of, he has a, like Achilles' weakness is in his heel or his
yes.
foot?
Well, he has a really primitive circulatory system.
That's right.
Right? It's right. all just one giant circle, and there's a little spigot, a kind of a hole.
Yes.
Where there's a nail in there.
That's right. That's right.
And Medea's genius is that she says to, I don't know if it's Castor and Pollux, but two other of the members of the crew, go pull that little nail out of Talos's circulatory system and he'll bleed out.
And problem solved.
Yes. I don't know if he bleeds out adamant or bronze or ash.
What's in there? I don't think that we know that detail.
But that's the end of him.
Yeah.
So what happened to those bronze people, Jeff?
Oh, I'll tell you what happened to those bronze people. Hesiod tells us that they killed each other off with their own hands and then went down into the bone-chilling halls of Hades.
So what happened to their houses of bronze and their weapons of bronze and their wardrobes of bronze?
It was all bronze, you say?
I think it was all bronze all the time.
Yeah, I don't think they could take it with them.
No.
No. So the next generation is interesting. It's the one that Ovid, in his version of the story, leaves out.
He leaves it out altogether.
Yep. And it's the age of heroes. So we get this uptick in the graph.
So heroes is stuck in between bronze and iron.
And iron, right. Where things have been declining.
Right.
And then suddenly for a brief moment in time, things get, men are men once again.
This will be a couple of generations.
Yes.
In between bronze and iron.
Right.
So these are the people that they were fighting around the gates of sheep-loving Thebes.
Sheep-loving Thebes, yes.
Or they were off at Troy fighting
over
Helen.
Right. So the famous Greek heroes that most people are familiar with from mythology come from this era, from this generation.
Okay. Why do you think Hesiod inserts this here?
You know, I always tie it back to that kind of that hope, this idea that there's the potential for any next generation to do better. So I think that's where I see kind of maybe a silver lining, maybe a little bit of optimism amongst the pessimism of Hesiod. It could be just me, but that's how I interpret why Hesiod put this in there.
So these generations of the heroes, they die,
mm-hmm.
but Zeus gives them kind of a happy burial.
Yes.
They move to the islands of the blessed out somewhere in the far west.
Right, kind of a Greek heaven.
Definitely. It's very much like, I think it's Numenor in the Tolkien poems.
Oh, yeah.
Islands of the blessed in the far west,
right.
This idea.
Right.
And there they have a grain-giving plow land, the Nelson translation. It bears crops thrice yearly. Abundant and honey rich.
So it's a return to the golden age.
Temporarily.
Yep.
Yeah. A pause in the decline.
Pause in the decline.
What happens next after the age of heroes?
And then the graph plunges even lower and we're down into the iron age.
And that's the age in which we live.
Yes. And Hesiod saw himself living in as well. Right.
Right.
So, and everything's bad. Right. So this is where you have to work for everything. You have to sweat. You have to toil. Nothing is given to you. You have to scrap for your living. And this is, again, coming back to his brother Perseus, this is one of the lessons he wants his brother to learn.
So in the book of Daniel, there's the vision of the statue, right?
Oh, right.
That Daniel has.
Nebuchadnezzar's dream.
Correct. Yep. Made up of different kinds of metals. So the use of metal as a way of describing different levels of quality and moral degeneracy, exchange of kingdoms, very common idea.
There, I think, goes from a head of gold down to the feet are of iron and clay.
Mixed with iron and clay.
Right. Yep. Yeah, exactly.
So what is the Iron Age like in Hesiod's time? What are some of the descriptions that he gives?
Let me read a little bit.
Okay.
Hesiod writes, I wish I had nothing to do with this fifth generation. Wish I had died before I'd been born after, because this is the Iron Age. Not a day goes by a man doesn't have some kind of trouble. Nights, too, just wearing him down. I mean, the gods send us terrible pain and vexation. So not much good here.
No.
Everything's bleak, and there's apparently no coming back from this.
Right. Justice has fled the land.
Yes.
As well as Nemesis.
Nemesis, right.
Now, who is Nemesis, and how does she function here?
Nemesis responds to hubris. If you act hubristically, you invite Nemesis, kind of the, in some ways, moral powers of the universe in the Greek conception of things.
So not only Nemesis or retribution, as one translation takes it, but also shame or iados. These both flee the human race.
So what do you make of that?
During the Iron Age. Well, it's just utterly bleak and hopeless. It's what has often been called Hellenic pessimism.
Right.
Things are bad and they're only getting worse.
Yeah.
We can't expect another uptick, another heroic age to be inaugurated.
Right. And I would say to some degree that it does color a lot of the subsequent myths and legends of the Greeks.
And the Romans as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are very few, if any, exceptions to this concept.
Right. Not a lot of hope for your average Joe.
No, definitely. Yep. Envy will be men's companion, says Nelson, harsh-worded, delighting in evil and hateful, and men will have misery. And then, their forms covered in white, forsaking mankind for Olympus to be with the gods, away from the wide paths of the land, will go retribution and shame. And what will be left for men is bitter pain and no help against evil.
Right. So in terms of the kind of the two kinds of strife, it's only the bad kind
that remains.
Right.
Yep. So we move from this then into perhaps the most memorable, for me at least, more than Pandora, the most memorable aspect of this beautiful poem. and that is the fable of the hawk and the nightingale.
Right.
Today's episode is also sponsored by the Moss Method for Greek.
The Moss Method. Tell us about the Moss Method.
Well, this is a way that I have developed for students who have an interest in the Greek language to go from absolute beginner to a fairly high level of expertise in a fairly short amount of time.
This works.
It works, absolutely. I have students all over the world in places like Australia, Scotland, South America. People are studying the Greek language with me via the Moss Method.
That's fabulous. So if someone were interested, how would they go about getting into this?
Well, they would go to mossmethod.com, okay. M-O-S-S, method, just like it sounds, .com. They would check out some of the introductory videos, the samples I've put up there. They'd look around, and then they would decide, of course, inevitably, mm-hmm. that they want to study Greek with me. And they would enroll. I have a simple shopping cart checkout way to go through this. They'd get in the course, then they would get access to all of my expertise.
That sounds fabulous. So they're going to enroll. So what would it cost them to do
this? $299.
Okay.
And that gets them 40 lessons. It gets them 6 quizzes. Who doesn't like a quiz?
Of course.
It gets them 2 exams. But most importantly, my constant feedback as they make their way through this self-paced but expertly guided, accessible course, Introduction to Ancient Greek.
Brilliant. Mossmethod.com.
That's right. This will be a way for you to learn how to read Hesiod and all the things we're discussing on this podcast.
Check it out.
Mossmethod.com. So, Jeff, how does this fable fit into the tale? What's the narrative thread?
Well, it's hard to see. I think there's a lot in Hesiod I see as kind of a, you know, warning about authority, kind of anti-authority. I think I see some of that kind of that Greek little man spirit kind of punching here. And this fable is often taken to be kind of a warning about kings and okay. tyrants. Right.
So Perseus is appealing to the judges.
Yes.
Perseus is trying to get more of his brother's property. Hesiod's property in this lawsuit.
Yep.
He's got enough, but he's grabbing it more. Bad kind of strife.
Right.
And these judges are corrupt, aren't they?
Yes.
They're not individuals who will weigh things in the balance equally, similar to the complaints that Amos makes in his prophecies. And so then Hesiod says, beware.
Beware.
Right.
Right. So in the story, we have a hawk swooping down and grabbing the nightingale, the bird of the beautiful song,
right.
which some take to be kind of representing Hesiod in some ways, which is
innocent, gentle.
Yes.
Interested in simple pleasures like singing and so forth.
Exactly right.
And the hawk comes down, grabs it in its talons. And now, what's interesting to me about this, before we get to the meat of the story, so
yeah,
to speak,
yes.
is that this is an appeal to nature, right?
Oh, yeah, right.
So like many of the epic similes in the Homeric poems,
right.
nature is looked to as normative.
Right, right.
You can find out something about human experience, human society, by looking at nature. And here we have this theme coming up again. This predates Aesop, I think,
right.
who in his prose works takes this to its limit, you might say, develops right. this idea.
It's the first of the kind of Aesopian fables that appears
correct.
in Greek literature.
If you want to know how to behave, look at the world of animals.
Right.
Although here there's a negative twist.
Yes.
So take us through the elements of this simple story here.
So the hawk swoops down, grabs the nightingale, and basically tells the nightingale, I'm taking you off and you're going to be my dinner.
So, Jeff, read us a little bit of that, will you, from the poem, please?
I will. So the hawk grabs the nightingale, and Hesiod says, she, the nightingale, complained something pitiful, and he made this high and mighty speech to her. This is the hawk. No sense in your crying. You're in the grip of real strength now, and you'll go where I take you, songbird or not. I'll make a meal of you if I want, or I might let you go. Only a fool struggles against his superiors. He not only gets beat, but humiliated as well.
Wow, that is really sad.
It's very bleak.
Grim.
Very grim, very, very pessimistic. It's all part of that thread, that shadow that Hesiod casts. But there is a lesson to be learned here, isn't there?
A lesson for Perseus.
For Perseus.
Yeah, and so Hesiod says, so Perseus, that's his brother, you listen to justice. Don't breed outrage and insult. Outrage is an evil for a poor man. Not even a great one can carry it lightly. When he meets with ruin, then he bows down under its weight.
Ah, yes.
So the world is ordered, the natural world is ordered, as might makes right.
Yes.
But human society, it's not supposed to be like that.
So there's a place for civilization. As much as nature is kind of the model for the golden age, civilization can offer kind of an antidote to the kind of the red in tooth and claw of nature.
Absolutely. The first time that I heard this story, it reminded me of something I had read from, of all places, Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, do tell.
It's a reversal of this idea. This is taken from his speech at the Cooper Union. Hmm. This was New York City, February 27, 1860. So Lincoln says, this is in the run-up to the election, "Neither let us be slandered from our duty by false accusations against us, nor frightened from it by menaces of destruction to the government, nor of dungeons to ourselves. Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it."
So right makes might.
Yes, it's a reversal of this Hesiodic notion,
yeah,
which I don't think Hesiod is accepting. He doesn't like it. He says the natural world is the hawk takes the nightingale, consumes and devours it. And there's no sense standing up to greater strength.
Right.
You're going to get beaten and insulted in the process.
Right.
But Lincoln says, let's reverse that and have some hope, some optimism that in the long run, right, you know, being on the right side of something will eventually give you the strength to prevail.
That's really interesting, right? I see in Hesiod a bit of feistiness. I think you see a little bit of maybe the rumblings of that democratic spirit, but he's not there yet.
Well, there's definitely a contrast between the aristocracy of the Homeric world, this is what the literature says, I find it persuasive, and the need for the peasant to have some self-respect, some standing in the world of Hesiod.
Right.
All right, Jeff, so that brings us pretty much to the end of this episode.
That's right.
We've looked at some of the works and days. Now, there's a bit left after this part, right?
Yeah.
After the hawk and the nightingale. What does the rest of the poem look like in broad outlines?
There's lots of the aphorisms, like you were talking earlier. There's
okay.
It gets really plowy.
The day part, right?
The day part.
This is what you do on this day. This is what you do on that day.
I think we certainly hit the greatest hits here.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Also, some general advice, like, don't take a wife, but if you do, take one that doesn't eat too much.
There's that misogyny again.
Don't urinate into the wind, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right, right.
There's quite a bit of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And maybe not enough for the rest of the episode.
No, but nothing you can't Google.
But what did we get out of this one?
Well, I think we see the kind of the seeds of that Hellenic pessimism
mm-hmm.
here. We see that kind of twisting in the wind, being kind of left at the mercy of the gods.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
This is so prominent in later literature, especially tragedy, the
right.
5th century, Sophocles, right? You can't escape the will of the gods. Fate controls all.
Right. We get a view of the common man as opposed to Homer's point of view. There's that element there as well.
The need for moderation that we touched on.
Exactly, right.
Good strife, bad strife.
The tension between nature and civilization.
Right.
So there's a ton here that I think leaves its fingerprints on so much that comes after.
So speaking of what comes after, Jeff, what do we have on tap for next week?
We're going to do more Hesiod.
All right.
Yes, we're going to do his Theogony.
Yes, the Theogony, the family tree of the gods.
Yes, the birth of the gods.
Where'd they come from?
We are going to find out next week.
Okay, and you get to take us out with this week's gustatory parting shot, the gastro-classical leave you with it.
I do. And this comes from Scott Adams, who is the cartoonist and mind behind Dilbert.
Right. The pointy-headed executive,
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And this is what he has to say. "I love you like a fat kid loves cake."
That's great. Thanks for listening.
See ya.